The system of ijtihad and marja taqlid has long been seen as the cornerstone of Shia Islam. Ever since the occultation of the 12th Holy Imam, our leading scholars have been at the forefront of the development and guidance of our creed. Founded on the basis of intellectual struggle and endeavor, our leading scholars have dedicated their lives in mastering the Islamic sources of law, in a bid to extract the canonical principles that make up our Sharia. Grounded deep with a sound scriptural basis, the system of ijtihad and marja taqlid sets the school of the Ahlul Bayt at the forefront of Islamic law. Having said that, in recent times, the system of marja taqlid has come under greater levels of critique and appraisal, leaving an arousing sense of doubt and confusion. We've therefore scoured our resources in a bid to highlight the most common criticisms and misconceptions, addressing them to some of our leading scholars.
Taqlid, in fact, is a principle which comes from the logic when every human being needs any field of knowledge. His intellect tells him to refer to the experts of that specific field of knowledge.
As individuals, as human beings, it becomes extensively difficult for us to seek how each law is derived by ourselves. And I'll give you a simple example. Today we have this issue, for instance, of wearing anything which is used from the skin of animals which are not slaughtered in the Islamic way. It is not a dhabiha, for instance. Who can dictate whether this is permissible or not?
The matters of religion must accordingly be referred to specialists, experts. Islam does not allow any religious act without evidence. In fact, Islam teaches us to keep all our behavior and stands and actions based on evidence. No religious act can be proper without proper evidences to prove that this is the real religious act which must be done.
Our scholars have said you can be one of three. You either yourself become a mujtahid. Number two, no, you cannot be a mujtahid, but you do not want to follow someone. And there is an option which is extremely difficult to practice, and that is ihtiyat, to practice precaution in everything. So for instance, am I allowed to wear this belt? I will not wear a belt at all. I do not know the ruling. I'm not following, but I am practicing precaution in every aspect, which is in reality an extremely difficult thing to do. And the third example is to follow somebody.
It is not practical to ask everyone to go and spend most of his life in research in the Islamic sciences. That's why Islam said that you must, if you are unable to deduct the Islamic rule, which is the case with almost majority of people, then you must rely on the research of the highest and most learned Islamic scholars.
Now, the whole idea of returning back to people who are knowledgeable in terms of Sharia law was something that did not all of a sudden emerge after the occultation, the major occultation of the Holy 12th Imam. In fact, it was practiced during the lives of the Imams themselves. We have numerous traditions that point to this reality. That, for instance, the 5th Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, tells his trusted companion Aban ibn Taghlib, he says to him, sit in the gatherings of people, waftin nas, give fatwas to people. فإني أحب أن يرى في شيعتي مثلك. I love to see in my Shia examples like you.
The Aima themselves from the 9th, 10th, and the 11th Imams. They appointed many deputies in Qom, in Ahvaz, within Iraq, in other places, in Medina, and other places. And that was the beginning of Marja'iyya.
After the occultation, the major occultation of the Holy 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif, of course there was a void.
The whole concept became extremely strong in the beginning of the occultation of the 12th Imam alayhi salam, when he, in his minor occultation, appointed a deputy. In the major occultation of the 12th Imam alayhi salam, it is no one can ever claim that he is the specified or the special deputy to the Imam alayhi salam, but rather they're all naib-i-am, general deputies to the Imam alayhi salam, where he has given you the conditions. If any one of these ayatullahs or marjas, any one of them has those conditions in him, then you can follow him. Otherwise, you cannot follow him. 11th Imam alayhi salam, Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam, he says that, وَأَمَّا مَنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْفُقَهَاءِ سَعِنْ لِلنَّفْسِهِ حَافِذًا لِدِينِهِ مُخَالِفًا لِهَوَاهُ مُتِيعًا لِأَمْرِ مَوْلَهُ فَلِلْعَوَامِ أَنْ يُقَلِّدُوهُ. He says that if any one of the maraji, any of the mujtahideen or the experts have these conditions in them, then he uses the word taqleed, فَلِلْعَوَامِ أَنْ يُقَلِّدُوهُ, then it is upon the common people to follow, to do taqleed of such a marja or such an expert. What are these conditions? He says, وَأَمَّا مَنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْفُقَهَاءِ, amongst the fuqaha, not amongst any common person, not amongst any other alim or expert, but they have to be faqih. Faqih is an expert in deriving the jurisprudential rulings from the rightful sources. So the imam does not go into the details, but he says that he's already assuming that everyone should refer to an expert, to a faqih only, not to any other person, but to a faqih. So the first condition is that he should be a faqih. Second is that sa'il al-nafsi, the one who protects himself from sins. Mukhalifan lihawa, he goes against his evil desires. Muti'an li'amri ma'ullah, he should be obedient to the orders and commands of his ma'ula. Hafidhan li'dinihi, I've missed out. Hafidhan li'dinihi, he looks after the religion. So whenever there is a bid'ah or whenever there is a problem in religion and people want to innovate anything in religion, he will take a stand and he will protect the religion. Just like Sayyidul Shuhada alayhi salatu wasalam gave his life, the fuqaha have the duty in the absence of the Imam alayhi salam to take a firm stand on anything that is against religion. So when you see all of these conditions in a faqih, then you should follow him.
We have traditions from the Imam himself, such as one which is quite famous and found in the book Wasa'il al-Shia, whereby the Imam himself says, وَأَمَّا الْحَوَادِثْ الْوَاقِعَةِ, as far as the questions and the matters that occur, in other words, that you need understanding and further clarification and answers to, فَرْجِعُوا إِلَيْهَا إِلَى رُوَّاتِ حَدِيثِنَا, فَرْجِعُوا فِيهَا, go back to people who narrate our traditions. فَإِنَّهُمْ حُجَّتِي عَلَيْكُمْ وَأَنَا حُجَّةُ اللَّهِ, they are my proof over you and I am Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's representative and proof on this earth. This is from the Imam alayhi salam himself.
I was once inquiring from one of my teachers that how many verses do you think there are in the Holy Quran that actually refer to Marja'iyya? He said every verse in the Holy Quran that refers for a layman to refer to an expert refers to taqlid.
There is one ayah predominantly which is used to support the concept of taqlid, and that is in chapter 9, Surah At-Tawbah, verse 122. The Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala here addresses us and says, وَمَا كَانَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ لِيَنْفِرُوا كَافَّ, it is not for all believers to place their efforts in continuous fashion in understanding and deriving the laws. فَلَوْلَا نَفَرَ مِنْ كُلِّ فِرْقَةٍ مِّنْهُمْ طَائِفَةٍ. From every group of them, there should emerge a number, a few. لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ. They should seek to understand and study religion in depth. And then the ayah goes on to say, وَلْيُنذِرُوا قَوْمَهُمْ إِذَا رَجَعُوا إِلَيْهِمْ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَحْذَرُونَ. These people, when they come out of the bigger community, they learn the religion and understand the background in detail. And then the verse says, when people come to them, they will immediately answer their questions.
That's why the fuqaha say it is wajibe kifaya. So if some people go and learn religion, then it is not wajib on the rest of the people. Just like if some people go and become medical doctors, then it is not wajib for the whole of the ummah to become doctors. Just as we refer to all other experts in other fields. So it is wajib for some people to learn religion. So therefore it is wajib for the rest of the people to do taqleed of these people who are experts in fiqh or in religion, so they can learn their religion from them.
All systems and technologies go through a natural progression and evolution. Ijtihad and marja taqleed is no different. Therefore, how did the system develop into the structure we have today?
People who make such claims have not read or not understood what they have read about the history of Shia Islam. In fact, it started from the time of the Prophet himself.
Over the 1,000 years, over 1,100 years, things have evolved. Our usul al-fiqh had started off extremely basic. People like Sheikh Murtaza Ansari are the ones who have refined everything. For example, the first few ahadith or works, the beginning works, are from the students of Imam Baqir alayhi salam and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam on usul al-fiqh. But the first book that we have is by Sheikh Mufid, the second marja in the major occultation.
Some of our fuqaha before Sheikh al-Ansari, like Sheikh al-Murtada, Sheikh al-Mufid and others, actually wrote about this, not in their books of fiqh, but in their works related to usul. So if you go back to that, you'll see this references and you'll see the emphasis placed upon returning back to the scholars of knowledge, the fuqaha, in matters of Islamic law.
It was further developed by his student Sayyidina Murtada, and then his student and the student of Sayyidina Murtada, the student of Sheikh Mufid and Sayyidina Murtada, Sheikh Tusi, the founder of the Hawza in Najaf, who moved the Hawza from Baghdad to Najaf. He wrote in a lot of detail, extended the works on Usul al-Fiqh. When it came, the time came to the likes of Sheikh Murtada Ansari, who is known to be Khatam al-Fuqaha al-Mujtahideen. He had developed Usul al-Fiqh into a new phase, and he wrote Faraid al-Usul or Rasail. And that was a new era that began from Sheikh Murtada onwards. And there was another concept that had actually come in, that you basically had direct access to Najaf rather than referring to small Mujtahideen in your own areas, for example, in Tehran or in Qom or in Mashhad or other places, in for example, Isfahan or even in Lucknow in India. People started referring to A'lam, the most learned scholar. So Sheikh had worked so much so that everyone started referring to him.
When the communication became easier, so the referring to the most learned became more centralized. That is the difference. It is not that it is a new phenomenon. No. It is going on since 1400 years.
Having established the idea of following the most learned, the question then begs itself, how can you tell who that is?
The layman is not able to make out who is the most learned. It is like any other profession. who knows who is most learned surgeon in UK? The layman knows, or the high caliber surgeons know? Of course, the high caliber surgeons know who is the most learned surgeon. We cannot refer a professional issue to non-professional people.
And there are three ways to know this. First of all, by seeking the opinion of two who are known as experts, Ahlul Khibra. And they are usually mujtahids, or those at that particular level. And number two, if an individual themselves have attained this level of understanding and knowledge and are able to make that distinction, then they can do that. And number three, they say there is something called al-shia al-mufid lil-itmi'nan, which means if there's widespread understanding and agreement amongst the masses, which brings certainty. And we had that in the past in many years, whereby people accepted generally that there is a knowledge, that there is a marja taqlid that stands as the most knowledgeable.
Paying khums is a fundamental duty on every Muslim as outlined in the Quran. However, why is it that khums is allocated to the marja? And secondly, can one allocate their khums straight to the needy? In days gone by, there were people who used to hide their khums until the reappearance of the imam. How can we understand this today?
First of all, the khums was established in the lifetime of the Holy Prophet. People had to pay khums on certain issues, you know, on certain things. And further down the line, from the 8th imam onwards, he gave very clear hadith on what things zakat is wajib and what things khums is wajib. For example, he said that on 9 things you pay zakat and on 7 things you pay khums. The A'imma alayhi salam used to themselves take the khums and give it to the poor sadat and help the non-sadat as well through same imam.
Because of the idea that the maraja are the representatives of the imam, in accordance with the traditions that we have cited, this portion of the khums is known as sahmul imam, the portion that belongs to the imam, and the marja as a representative of the imam takes it and deals with it accordingly, because they are God conscious, because they fit a number of important qualities and characteristics.
The procedure of giving the khums to the marja of taqlid is for the safety and also to be sure that this amount will be utilized in the proper place, because not everyone knows where is the proper need and most trusted people. Anyone who knows any required place for khums can seek permission from the marja of taqlid. For example, he knows poor people in his area who need help. He can seek permission. And after he seeks permission, usually the marja is of taqlid. Give permission in every genuine case.
If, for example, a person today, a mujtahid or a marja, said that you cannot utilize the imam yourself, this belongs to the imam, and all of us should open a bank account in the name of the 12th imam, and everyone should just put their same imam, you know, the portion of the imam al-Islam, in a bank account. And when the 12th imam comes, he will utilize it. That was the concept of burying their homes. So all the people started burying their khums and they said that we cannot utilize it. The 12th Imam wrote a taqi. He sent a signed command from himself and he said it to one of his deputies in the minor occultation and he said, no, al-khumsu mubahun li shi'atina. The khums is permissible to be used upon our shias. For Sahmi Sa'adat, the portion of the Sayyids, many of the fuqaha say it is a precautionary step that you should give it to the marja. So he can give it to the deserving Sayyids, or you can give it out, you should look for the poor Sayyids, and especially if a person is a Sayyid himself, because there are now many Sayyids, so they should look for the Sadat who are poor in their own family. If there is a deserving person, then it is wajib for him to give it to them.
However, there are conditions that exist, and if we can fulfill these conditions, no problem. What are these conditions? So for instance, it must not be one's own dependence. It must not be an individual, for instance, who has neglected prayers, or they are engaged in drinking intoxicants, or, for instance, spending it in haram avenues. These must be fulfilled. And if there is a Sayyid who is a poor individual, then our Maraji allow this particular segment to be given to them, provided the conditions are fulfilled.
The Maraji are there for our legal Sharia issues. However, we're finding that people are naturally attracted to their ideological frameworks as well. What is your opinion on this?
All fuqaha, the first issue in the Tawdil Masail or Risala Amaliyah or any other detailed book, they were the first mas'ala or the first issue they will write is that it is haram for people to do taqleed in usuluddin, in the principles of faith or in ideological matters.
No one is allowed to claim that I believe in tawheed or I believe in nubuwa or imama or adl or ma'ad yawm al-qiyamah because my marja said that or my father said that. No.
You must have even the slightest and the simplest answer from yourself to prove to you. For example, there is a hadith by Imam Sadiq al-Islam that asked him a question that, do we need our personal research to believe in one God? He said, yes. He said, how strong should it be? He said, stop. There was an old lady sitting down making thread. He said, do you believe in one God? She said, yes, I do. He said, do you have a proof to prove to yourself that you believe in one God and there is only one God? So she started thinking, how do I prove that there is only one God? And then she stopped and she said, well, if this small machine needs me to run it, then how can this whole universe run without a God? Then a God is needed. A God is needed for running this whole universe. He said, as simple as that. You don't need a philosophical argument. If you have a proof as simple as this woman, then you are right. Then you have a proof yourself. Then you have not followed another person. You have not done taqleed to prove the existence of one God to yourself. But you have your own proof. It could be as simple as that.
You can study and you can ask and you can consult, but you cannot follow blindly. While in the day-to-day rules, now if someone asks you that in the third rak'ah you recite Tasbihatul Arba'ah three times, what is the evidence? If you say, I have no evidence, you are all right, because it is not your job to have evidence. It is a matter of marja of taqleed.
The Quran tells us, فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Ask those who understand the Quran if you do not know.
It becomes so difficult for many people to see. They may do some research and they think, well, this makes sense. But do we refer to an expert who is an expert in theology or in philosophy to give an answer to certain disputes on Tawheed or Adl or Nabuwa or Imama and Qiyama? Yes, we need experts who actually spend a lifetime doing research and they say, no, this is the right answer. And it is not possible for laymen to do all of that research. In fact, I've spent most of my life now learning religion and doing research into religion. Even then, I cannot for certain give answers for many of the ideological arguments. I have to refer to many experts who have spent some time and have written books on those issues and then take out the answers from their research and take it further from there.
There was a time when there was one agreed marja. Today there are various different ones. Has this affected our overall unity and caused certain underlying divisions?
In the book of Ibn al-Athir, very well-known Sunni writer, he writes that inside Kufa, that time Kufa was one of the most important centers of Shia Islam, there are people referring to Muhammad bin Muslim, referring to another scholar, all of them are followers of Ahlul Bayt, but they had different high caliber scholars that they refer to, and nothing wrong in that at all. It does not mean disunity.
Diversity is a healthy trend. It certainly within the marja'iyya system, it shows that how the school of Ahlul Bayt has opened up this door of ijtihad and has allowed people to come forward and to understand the texts and to look at the sources in that particular way.
It always is a blessing to have one single marja, if everyone is unanimously agreed upon that he is the most learned. And there have been many times when, for example, in the time of Sheikh Murtada Ansari, all the scholars said, no, he is the most learned. It has happened many times. For example, there were three maraji in Najaf. Sheikh Muhammad Hussain Naini, Sheikh Muhammad Hussain Isfahani, and Sheikh Ziauddin Al-Araqi. These were the three maraji in Najaf when Ayatollah Sayyid Abu Hassan Isfahani came. And all three of them said that, no, he is a'lam, he is more learned.
And what we have to realize is that the maraji themselves don't have an issue with it. Unfortunately, sometimes it's the followers who make out of these differences something bigger than what it is, use it for political reasons and for other purposes as well.
In Najaf, during the time of great marja's, one marja was leading the prayers in the haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Another marja was dealing with the questions of people, istifta'at, getting fatwa. A third marja was dealing with khums, receiving and disputing the khums, and no dispute at all.
People are very slightly more or less similar to each other because one is more learned in one chapter and the other one is more learned in another. And they're very similar. They are not clearly more learned. You know, there is no person very clearly more learned than all of the maraji, like in our time. So there are a few people who are very learned and you don't know which one is the most learned. Then you can refer to any one of them.
Imam alayhi salam informed the students that when you hear somebody say something, would you understand it exactly the same way as someone else? And the response was no. There will be some difference. He says, if you are saying that you will misunderstand or understand the statement of a human being differently, what about the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
It is not a matter of political leadership. Political leadership, yes. When it is more than one leadership, it creates disputes. But it is a matter of religious guidance.
This may cause a problem if the wukala do not cooperate with each other. The deputies or the representatives of those maraja are not in good, strong relationship with each other. They can, this has no problem if they all cooperate with each other and take up different projects and do not, there is no, you know, if they stop to, you know, contradict each other and there is no conflict of interest, then there is no problem with having many maraja.
There is no question of dispute. Unless some ignorant persons try to misuse the situation and deal with it in a political thinking, that wrong way of political attitude with the taqleed creates the misunderstanding between people. Otherwise, the taqleed itself can never create any difference between the different muqallideen.
But this does not happen all the time. And that's when the problems start to arise. The maraji themselves do not have any problem with each other. They would not enter the domain of each other. They would do not, you know, they're all serving religion. They're all teaching. They're all trying to serve the community at large. It is the deputies who have to go to different countries to try and solve the problems of the community and take the communities further.
We should avoid politicizing the concept of taqlid. It is not a political stand. It is a shar'i responsibility. When you are following any marja, you are not enrolling your name in any political party. You are following the marja because according to the evidences that you have got, he is the most learned and you take his verdicts to make your religious acts proper.
Many people have put forward the idea of tab'idh, which allows one to take rulings from various different maraja. What is your opinion on this?
Our ulama say that this is applicable only in certain instances. For instance, some of our maraja say only in rulings which are considered part of ihtiyat wujubi, obligatory precaution.
All maraja say that tab'idh or partial taqlid is allowed, so long as you know who is the most learned in a particular issue.
Our ulama sometimes come to an understanding that based on obligatory precaution, you should not do the following. Some of our ulama say, in that respect, you are allowed to follow another marja, but importantly, and here's the crunch, that other marja must be considered a'lam, more knowledgeable in that area, in that field, in that question.
In taqlid, you cannot do tab'idh to pick and choose whatever you like best you'll pick out. Unfortunately, this is what's happening. People say tab'idh is allowed, and what they do is they pick and choose what, you know, to their personal like and dislike. And you would only and only use the tab'idh concept when you have a conflict amongst all the maraji, for example, on the moon, on the sighting of the moon, then you follow your own marja, but then you come and do tab'idh to solve this problem of the moon. So you'll only and only use that for the entire society as a you know, problem solver, not as a creator of many different problems that you pick and choose. It is not the matter of pick and choose.
Where do we draw the line when it comes to following a marja? What if we feel something just doesn't make sense? For example, the ruling on free use of copyrighted material.
When it comes to Islamic law, one finds it extremely difficult to rationalize it. I cannot, for instance, explain using the aql why we pray 2 units, rak'atayn, salatul subh, and why 4 in dhuhr.
If someone feels that any verdict of the highest learned scholar does not make sense for him, he cannot compare his knowledge with the knowledge of the marja. We don't have a condition that you should follow the Islamic rule if it is accepted by you. There's no such condition.
If they have said that something is allowed and you don't feel comfortable, then you can stop from doing it. And if they have said that something is not allowed and you don't feel comfortable, then you cannot leave that. Then you must not do it. Because they've said this is haram. You cannot say that I don't feel comfortable that it is haram. No, you cannot do that. But if they say no, this is permissible, and you don't feel comfortable that, well, how can this be permissible? Then you must refrain from that. Or you can refrain from that. Or you can use this fatwa.
We have to understand that it's not about things making sense. It's not about whether my mind, my aql. Of course, there is a position for aql within the whole subject itself. Our ulama have placed importance upon it. But aql in terms of understanding the sources is crucial, not aql by itself, because that in itself cannot in a way be able to explain the hukum or the rulings.
On copyright, I think there are very strict fatwas at the moment. But the difference of opinion is that, does that apply to an Islamic state or does it apply to all the world? That is the only dispute at the moment. That do the copyrights issues, you know, if a person has said that this is my copyright, how far can he go with that? Many of the maraji have an issue that if you have used khums money or you have used Baitul Mal or you've used public money, public funding for an issue, and then you say, I have a copyright on this, then they all have a problem with that. Because you've used public funding, then how can you place a copyright? Because you've already used public funding, it is for all public. Anyone can use it now because you don't have a right over it. You've not spent your personal money on it. There is not a group of people who actually spent some money to make a business out of something. So how can you make it a business now? Because there is no copyright now. You've used public funding and all the public wants to use it. So they can actually use it however they like it because it's for all people. So that's where the maraji find it difficult to place a copyright on something.
Ijtihad and free thought is the basis and the pride of Shi'ism. However, do you think the system of marajiyya has led to a dependence where followers forego their innate nature to know and understand and merely just become followers?
Today we are encouraged to seek knowledge, to understand our faith. And I think, of course, it's recommended for people who wish to explore further and to develop themselves and to seek Islamic education to do so in the seminaries and to progress further in this field.
The system of ijtihad, which is open for everyone, encourages research. Non-Shia Muslims lack and don't have system of ijtihad until recently. Now they claim that they want to reopen it. But in Shia Islam, ijtihad and the scientific research is open to everyone.
And simply by claiming that we can understand things is a flawed concept. Think about it in such a way that if today we are told when it comes to the slaughtering of animals, they undergo the process of stunning. How do we know if this stunning is permissible or not? Are we able to come to that conclusion by ourselves? Are we able to somewhat think about this and come to a rational decision about it? And if we do, let's, for argument's sake, well, we say, you know what, it makes sense and it somewhat makes the animal suffer much less before slaughtering. Can this be justified on the Day of Judgment? That way, that methodology that we've come to derive this particular law, it's problematic.
The process of ijtihad is the best way to encourage research. And the process of taqleed is the best way to make people learn about their Shari'i and Islamic responsibilities and also to protect them from misguidance. They should not think that we go to Google and search and find. No, you cannot. It is not as simple as this. No, it needs years and years, or decades, in fact, to research till you are able to deduct the Islamic rule.
What do you think about the offices producing independently audited accounts like most charities? Do you think this will provide a greater transparency that will give more credibility to the system?
The maraji' of taqleed have got accounting system within their offices. And they know what was being received and what was being spent and from where received and to whom given. But publishing such accounts can, in certain countries, cause trouble to many people. mu'mineen.
I think many times there is this feeling that our enemies become more aware of what we're doing and how many projects we're running and how much we are doing in terms of religious work. They do not wish to disclose.
There is a fear that nepotism has crept into the system of Marja'iyya, which has led to people questioning its overall integrity. How far is this true?
You see, the most trusted people to anyone are their family members. And that's why many Maraja felt that they should actually appoint their, first of all, their sons and son-in-laws who are close to them and who would look after the interests of the Marja and not do embezzlement or fraud or anything that would harm him. Unfortunately, over the years, what has been seen is that one of the Maraja in Qum said to me that so long as the lion does not eat the human flesh, it keeps eating antelope, goats and sheep and everything. But as soon as the lion tastes the human blood, then it doesn't want anything else. Many people who have been deprived of, powers and financial powers and social powers, they come in with sincere intentions, and the Marja at the time of their appointment see them to be adil and fair and just. However, over the years and over the time, sometimes many people corrupt. We have seen many Maraji who have stripped their deputies from power and from office and appointed another person in their place. But it is a serious decision for a Marja to take before they strip a person of their power and defame them or replace them. I personally do believe that even if a person was appointed who better suited the position, there is a great chance of him corrupting. So it has happened many times. People were not family, and they were corrupted, and the Maraji had to remove them from office. You see many incidents from the life of Sayyid al-Khoi who removed so many people from office. Even the infallible imams had to remove many people from office. Imam Ali alayhi salam, if I'm not mistaken, one of the researchers has written that there wasn't a single governor appointed by Imam Ali alayhi salam who stayed in office for a whole year. So he removed each one of the governors every year, telling them off that this is what you've done wrong.
Do you think the Maraja should publicize their research when it comes to new fatwas being issued?
No Marja keeps his research secret. No Marja at all keeps any research secret. In fact, because of the knowledge of the scholars about the researches of the Marja, then they say he is really the most learned. But if you say that the Marja should publish in the newspapers his researches, that is not possible, because people will not understand, because it is very deep researches, and people will say that such researches mean very little to them because they don't understand that level of research. But the high caliber ulama, they are always in touch with the researches of the Marja through his lectures, Bahth al-Kharij, through his books, and through his writings.
People feel they're not necessarily in touch with their Maraja. Do the offices explore ways in which the Marja could become more apparent?
I think keeping up with the advances in technology is certainly something that we would promote and encourage the Maraja and Maraja offices to be doing. And we can see that, in fact, when we look at the websites of certain Maraja, that you can see it, that's modern, you're able to search for the questions and able to contact the offices and seek the answers. I think, for instance, when it comes to obtaining books and other sources, that's also available in the offices themselves. The idea of utilizing social media, perhaps, is something that needs to be explored further in order to connect with the masses at a greater scope and a greater level. Things like Facebook and Twitter, I think, is a good idea, especially for the youth to feel that they have this connection with the Maharaja's offices themselves.
The Marja is always try to serve the Mu'mineen. The Marja does not have any political planning to be a leader or to be well known or to be accepted by masses. No. He wants to guide people, to serve the followers of Ahlul Bayt, who are in the narrations called Aytam Ali Muhammad, the orphans of Ahlul Bayt.
We are not claiming that the system of Marja'iyah is perfect. I'm not saying everything there is working well. It certainly would help with reform in many aspects that would help it even progress and move with the times as well. I think work is being done in many areas, which is good to see. But in other areas, it's also important to have that. For instance, regular communication and statements and messages sent by the Marja to the followers.
So the Marja tries his best in every possible way to respond to the questions, to help people, to meet people, to receive people in every possible way.
But the key is, I think also, is for the followers to take the initiative. It's for the followers of a particular marja to say, you know, I want to help out. Contact the office concerned and say, I have a skill in a particular field. I am able to design a website. I'm able to film. I'm able to do this. And present their skills and offer their assistance. And I think most Maharaja, if not all offices, would welcome that and would really appreciate the efforts by the followers to actually help out in any aspect to increase this connectivity with the masses that is, alhamdulillah, very much needed at this day and age.
The Marja Taqleed is an expert in the field of extracting laws from the Quran and Hadith. However, he also needs to be aware of the various circumstances that people are facing throughout the world. These can range from complicated medical developments to banking and astronomy. How does the Marja keep updated with all these modern day developments? Wouldn't a localized system be more effective?
I feel that this idea of the Marja as being out of touch is slightly blown out of proportion and perhaps a myth in some respects. First of all, many of the Marajas have written books which detail rulings for people living in the West.
Our Marja or Maraja, they spend all their life in reading. They don't leave anything which they can read without going through it. So they know about the society in the West much more than many people who live in the West.
Secondly, they've also, of course, been constantly in touch with their representatives when it comes to certain areas, and they do undergo review of certain matters.
He is not staying in Najaf or Qum or somewhere else and away from what is going on in the world, no.
They understand the situation of what's happening, and they are constantly being fed information by their representatives, and they look at everything in that perspective. And you can see that when you read some of their works when it comes to the laws pertaining to those who live in the West. If we feel there are issues that perhaps are not being addressed or the Marja is unaware of, to make sure that that is communicated either to the office or the representatives, or if we have an opportunity to visit the Marja themselves in whichever city they reside in, to be able to present that ourselves.
We cannot claim that we have to have local Marja in every locality or every city even. Not practical. Because nowadays, the whole world is becoming one village. The whole globe is one village because of the fast communication. What is the point? This is number one. And number two, where can you justify following the less knowledgeable and leave the more knowledgeable?
We've had in the past localized systems, and the globalization of marja'iyya is much better than localizing. However, I do believe that there will be localized leaders. We will have a lot of leaders across the globe who are leaders, local leaders who look after the issues that pertaining that particular society. And that would be sufficient. So we don't need globalized marja'iyya. The marja will just issue his edicts, you know, his fatwas, and give research work. And the local leaders will run the affairs of homes, the social system, the political things. Everything will be run by local leaders. And that's emerging, and it will become, within the next 10 to 15 years, it will be so much stronger that all across the globe will have local leaders who will be running everything.
Can there ever be a marja who is a specialist in every legal field? And if they can't, then why not a shura of scholars?
One of the conditions for a marja to be a marja is that he should be a mujtahid mutlaq, meaning absolute expert. He has to be an expert in all the different, an expert, a mujtahid, a qualified mujtahid in all the different chapters of fiqh. Now, is he the most learned in every single chapter? That may not, you know, that may be under question mark, but this is not, the first question is not under question mark, that he's an expert. He is qualified in every field.
Every marja has an institution. So you have offices. Sometimes these offices are across the world. You have books being published. You have a website. You have followers and so on and so forth. So we look at it as an institution. So the marja'iyya system is made up of many institutions. And normally there is cooperation and contact between the maraja themselves and the offices. I recall in 2006, when the tragic bombings in Samarra took place and the destruction of the shrines of Imam al-Hadi and al-Askar alayhim salam happened, the maraja in Najaf all together congregated in one place and discussed the best way to go forward.
The marja will not give, for example, a verdict regarding the stock market before referring to the scholars who are specialized in the rules of economy and finance and stock market. The marja' will not give verdict in any medical issue without referring to those scholars who are more specialized than other scholars in the medical issues.
If you look at, for instance, an example of a marja, they will have people who are experts in different fields and walks of life that they can contact to, contact and seek information on anything that they would like further clarification. People, for instance, in the aviation industry, or people, for instance, who are engineers, and others who are medics, and others who are astronomers, and so on. So yes, there are people there who have contacts and relationship, and across the world as well. I have met some certain individuals who say that they are in constant contact, and they do provide advice about certain matters which come up from time to time.
In this way, the marja, being the highest in knowledge, is utilizing or getting the feedback, if we can call it, from the specialized people, and then applying on it the rules of ijtihad.
If we are to give an example, and sometimes examples and parables are given, but not to somewhat equate, if we look at the banking system, for instance, we have banks all together. Can we say all banks come together under one bank? It's very difficult. They may work with each other, but each have their own way of working and going about certain matters. As far as maraja who are specialized in fields, yes, maraja are there, and perhaps they have an area of expertise and speciality. But we're also told is that the maraja themselves seek the opinion of those who are experts.
Shura in political matters is possible. Shura in ijtihad and in taqleed, If they all decide that, yes, I will only issue fatwas on ibadat, the other one says, I will only issue fatwas on, for example, uqood, the third one says on iqa'at, the fourth one says on ahkam, then it may be workable that they make a council of four or five judge, you know, mujtahideen, who say that you will follow one in particular field, then the others will be experts in other fields. That is workable, but no other way is workable.
Some people feel that some of the fatawa are now outdated, especially those that ask for recompense in terms of paying certain numbers of camels, or the constant reference to commodities such as rice and wheat. Is there any work being done to modernize these rulings?
Now, if you look at the world population, you'll still have probably at least half the people living in villages where these people, these things still apply to. Wheat and rice, for example. And even the people living in the cities, they all eat wheat and rice. So to say that they are outdated, they will never ever be outdated, because there will always be people who will be in countryside. More than 60-70% of the Asian countries, 60-70% of their population in Asian and African countries are still living in villages. So to say that they are outdated is lack of knowledge.
We have, for instance, if you look at the history, in the recent history, modern history, our ulama have looked at some aspects, for instance, the ritual purity of certain individuals, the non-Muslims, the Ahlul Kitab and non-Ahlul Kitab. This has been studied extensively. And today, the opinion of the vast majority of our maraja is not the same as what it was in the 60s and the 50s in the last century. Completely different. Today they say the Ahlul Kitab are ritually pure, whereas this was not the opinion back in the time, which means that they are constantly looking at the sources again. They are trying to understand it in the modern sort of way. There is currently work being taken as to the opinions regarding apostasy, or, like I said, the length of fasting for certain people who have to fast for more than 16 hours or 18 hours and so on. What do they do? And in many other areas, certainly there is work taking place, and that's the beauty of the system of marja'iyah and taqleed itself. It's certainly not something that promotes stagnation. It is always evolving, always moving, encouraging people to present new evidence and for the maraja to look at it again.
Dr. Ayman Reda, in his thesis on the economical system of taqlid, equates the system of marja'iyah as a public good, where the masses are able to freely consume without the hindrance of any other users. Essentially, what he's saying is that the maraja have sacrificed their lives for the rest of the community. While they toil to extract the law from the sources of religion, the masses are able to consume the scholars' efforts, having relieved themselves from any burden. What's more, as Walbridge highlights, the mujtahid goes beyond his legal responsibility to safeguard the affairs of minors, such as orphans and the mentally handicapped, as well as those public endowments which have no guardians of their own, setting up schools and hospitals. Alas, the system remains as the cornerstone of the Shia madhab. Generation after generation, Shias have found their guidance through the maraja. As technologies and industries have continued to advance, so have the maraja, extracting the legal precedence on the basis of the Quran and the Sunnah of the last and final Prophet. We, the masses, will forever remain indebted to the sacrifices of the maraja. As one scholar aptly put it, if all Muslims were to neglect the obligation of ijtihad and taqlid, the line between what's right and wrong would be blurred beyond recognition.